Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Bucher and Friends podcast. Here is your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
Welcome to another coronavirus episode of Bucher and Friends, part of the United WeCast Network. I'm Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1, you can hear me on Fox Sports Radio, and you can read me by ordering the memoir of Brian Grant and his battle with young onset Parkinson's called Rebound. Pre-ordered copies are available now on Amazon. You can also follow me on both Twitter and Instagram at Rick Bucher. I'm a lot of places. But there's only one place you can hear me talking about story angles and perspectives that you are not likely to find anywhere else, primarily but not exclusively involving the NBA, and that is here. And it is my great pleasure to introduce my guest for today's episode, head coach of both the Toronto Raptors and the men's Canadian national team, Nick Nurse. Thank you, coach, for taking the time to join me. I want you to know right off the top that my goal is to ask you as many questions that you've never been asked before as I can.
All right. That sounds exciting. Good to talk to you, Rick. Long relationship we've had. I don't know if you know that or not, but we met a long time ago at lunch with Ian Whittle, the fabulous British journalist of soccer. A long time ago. So.
Yes.
Well, 20 plus years probably since we first met, so it's good to talk to you.
I'm wondering whether we actually ran across each other at Long Beach State when
probably
you were coming over, because that was I think that was a gold mine for you in a way, basketball wise, and it certainly was for me getting my feet wet when it comes to covering the NBA. I loved being in the pyramid. But before I get to my questions for you, I wanted, because I'm a giver, Nick, you may not know this, but I am. I wanted to answer a question for you, just in case someone hasn't already answered it. And that's that, as a Midwestern boy who thought he was going to the University of Cincinnati on a soccer scholarship and wound up graduating from Dartmouth, I can tell you that you would have done just fine at Cornell, that the hardest part of attending an Ivy League school is getting in. It sounds as if you had that covered. So in case no one has ever told you that, I know that that might have been a lingering question. For those who may not know, Nick, coming out of, Kemper Catholic? Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, that's right.
In Carroll, Iowa, was recruited by Cornell and did not go. Dad couldn't see him going to all the way to Ithaca?
Ithaca.
Yeah.
Ithaca, yeah. New York. Yeah. The quote is, "You're not going to Ithaca, New York." And that was back in those days, Rick, that was the end of the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, trust me. I understand. So, but I'm telling you, as someone who didn't expect to go to an Ivy League school and wound up at one, the absolute hardest part is getting in. Dartmouth had a great hockey team, still probably does. I know Cornell had a great hockey team, and that's your first indicator that, you know what, you don't have to be a 4.0 in order to survive at an Ivy League school.
There you go. Well, I was envy. Always wondered how it would have went if I would have went to Cornell instead of Northern Iowa. But I think pretty good path we ended up on.
Yeah, for sure. By the way, so I generally do this icebreaker with the show, with everyone who comes on. Nicholas David Nurse, why did your parents pick that name for you?
I have no idea, Rick. The only thing I can add to that story is I was going to be Nancy if I was a girl.
Oh, is that right?
So I guessed, Nancy. It was going to be Nancy Nurse, and I do know that much. So I guess they were just looking for an N. They were looking for a double N, and they went with Nicholas.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. You've been with the Raptors now since 2013, which, if my records are correct, is the longest that you've been with any organization in one stretch. Is that I'm correct on that, right?
Yeah. By a long shot.
It was about two
years and move, it seemed like, for a long time. So you know how it is in the coaching profession, especially overseas. But 8 years now here. It's been a heck of a run.
You might be the only person who is perfectly okay with last season being in the bubble and then being in Tampa Bay this year, because you've got the moving around thing. I'm thinking you might have had an itch. Like, I've been in one place too long. I need something to change.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, listen, we've got a great setup here, and obviously we get the great weather. But, man, the electricity in Toronto when we're playing in front of our own fans and the streets of Toronto's, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah.
So certainly miss that, but I guess that's not going on anywhere. So this is probably a pretty good alternative for us.
So I'm wondering, because you've traveled so much, and lived in so many different places. For those, by the way, who want to get the full rundown, Nick has written a book, Rapture, 15 teams, four countries, one NBA championship, and how to find a way to win damn near anywhere, which I didn't check Guinness, but that might be in the top 20 for longest titles of a book. But please go. I highly recommend it. It's going to lead you to buying a few other books, including Stuff Good Players Should Know by Dick DeFenzio. Just take my word for it. Order Rapture and order Stuff Good Players Should Know, and you'll thank me later. But I'm wondering, because you've been so many places, and I got to think you've got some travel hacks. Like, you know how to live in various places on a semi, you know, regular basis, like to put up for a couple months in a particular place and make it work as well as anybody might.
Yeah, I guess you get a little bit of that in your bones, right? You're a bit of a vagabond, and you just, man, for me, Rick, it was always get a place to put your things and get to work, man. You know, all I ever wanted to do was get my team to the gym to practice and get my team to the gym for the games and try to keep working at my craft, really. I tried to spend a lot of time studying film and reading books and talking to coaches and all that kind of stuff. I wasn't really that bothered about the surroundings. I figured there was always good in all places. And it was always super interesting to me to be able to go to somewhere new and see how to get along with people and fit in. And then the main job was trying to get good at being a coach, try to learn my craft.
What do you think inspired you? Because your curiosity of people and taking advantage of all the different places that you've been and the cultures that you lived in, what do you think it inspired you to explore those the way that you did?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I was coming to the close of my college playing career, going into my senior year, and literally, you're living that, man, like every second of the day, right? You know, it's working out, it's shooting before class, it's practices, it's, you know, you're just all in on it. And I was like, holy smokes, this is going to be over, because I knew I wasn't going to the NBA or whatever. And I was getting a degree in accounting, and I just was like a year out of being done from playing college basketball. I was like already kind of having withdrawal, you know, missed it. I was like, man, there's no way I can walk away from basketball right now. Right. And I just wanted to say, well, I guess I'll start coaching. And then I was kind of lucky enough to be able to play another year in England. And I, you know, wanted to do that. And I guess that's it. I just had a love for the game that I didn't want to give up on. And I wanted to try to make a living at it.
Now you, I also read that you travel with a keyboard. You play piano and you travel with a keyboard. Is that still the case?
Yep, that is the case. That is the case. I was one of those kids that my mom forced me to take lessons when I was like in fourth and fifth and sixth grade. And
you and me both, brother.
Playing about, huh?
You and me both.
Yeah, I was forced to play, but I was playing about seven sports at the time too, and I absolutely, well, I didn't like it very much. And about the only time I played was at the lessons, and you don't get very good. And it's kind of been one of those things in the back of my mind. I kind of started liking it as I got older, and could never really make any progress because of all the travel. And I decided I wanted to make some progress, and the only way I could do it was to start bringing the keys with me, so I could practice every day. Rick, gotta practice every day.
So what kind of keyboard? I've been playing. I went through this similar thing. My parents had me playing when I was six. I got to about 12, and I hated it. It was like a different Czerny exercise and a classical piece, and it was not cool. By the way, when I was becoming a teenager, it wasn't cool. And then luckily, I grew up in Cincinnati, where the Baldwin Music Company is located, and they were starting a program where they were teaching on electric pianos, and I had to audition to get in. And it was suddenly like, ooh, competition. Like, not, I don't have to do this. It's like, you have to be good enough to be allowed to do this. And I'll never forget, I was one of the older kids at 12. I was older, one of the older ones in the class. And there was a kid named Joel, 9 years old. And he was already playing piano for for the gospel choir in his church. And they had a jazz quartet come in when we had a recital to sort of like, we all played our stuff. And then the quartet came in and entertained the adults in a real way. And Joel walked up there and sat in with them. And I was like, I want to do some semblance of that. Like that's what I want to be able to do. So I don't know what your inspiration was for playing, but what is it that has you? I have a piano at the house, but I've never traveled with a keyboard. So your commitment is greater than mine.
It has to be. I got a similar story, Rick, and it kind of ties in with how we opened. So I got back from Europe as about, 2007, 2008. We were getting ready to start an expansion franchise in Des Moines, Iowa, in what was the NBA D League at the time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had a little lag time on my hands, and I'm surfing the net and I'm looking around, and I find that Harvard offers some extension graduate classes that you can take online. Mm-hmm. And I said, that sounds good. I'll take a class from Harvard. And the first class I decide to take is called History of Blues in America.
Oh.
And it was unbelievable. Like, seriously, the professor, a guy named Charles Sawyer, who I befriended, really good friends with today, he traveled and was with B.B. King for something like 15 years, was his photographer, and he had B.B. King come perform in the class.
Wow.
Anyway, So this is this awesome class, gets posted online every Wednesday night. I'd be up early Thursday. It's like, 2 hours of 2 hour jam session of blues and learning about the history and all this stuff. And about midway through the class, he came in and said, hey, to get an A in the class, you have to do a project. And I don't care what it is, as long as it's blues related. And I said to him, something kind of like you, I said, I always wanted to be able to play blues on the piano.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll find a piano and I'll find a teacher and I'll record a blues number and turn it in as my final project. And he said, go for it. So I started in on that, and it was just like you mentioned, as a little kid, I felt like I was in fourth grade again. You know, it was a struggle, you know, reading the notes and trying to play it. And this class was virtual, but it was held in the classroom at Harvard. I told them I wanted to come to one class. You know, we started to kind of, again, like become friends a little bit. He was following my team and all this kind of stuff. And I went out there, and he got me one lesson, one piano lesson with a blues guy that was just a phenomenal teacher and a great player. And he gave me one lesson on how to play improv blues. And and then literally a couple weeks later, it like clicked in, and I was working. You know, I was on the road. I was in every hotel trying to find a piano, and I was working like heck. And that's it. That's what turned me on, was that class I took, and kind of took it from there.
That's the beauty of the 12 bars, which is like you can just improvise on it. You can play forever, and or every time you sit down and play something else off of kind of the same basic chords, right? That's
exactly right.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Have you ever
up and down the keyboard? Sounds good.
Yeah. Have you ever jammed with or talked to Rick Carlisle about playing piano?
I have not. I know Rick is really good. I've never jammed with him. There's been some suggestions of people trying to get us together.
Yeah.
But I have not done that yet. But I think he's really, really good, I think.
He's sat in with Bruce Hornsby. And
yowza.
When he was in Indiana, he and I went in there to do a story, and he invited me out to the house. We knew each other through the Pete Newell Big Man Camp. And he had like this 12-foot grand, and he had this whole recording thing set up. And anyway, I think we did it in Hawaii too at the Big Man Camp, where found a piano in a hotel, and we're just going back and forth. And he can really play. I'm okay, but he is like he's really, really good. It was a lot.
That's what I hear. Awesome.
Yeah. So, what if anything does Toronto and Tampa have in common? By the way, is it how much of a culture shock is it for you to be operating down there? Aside from just, and I don't even know what your setup is, whether you've got the family down there or how you're handling this.
There's not a lot in common. I'll say that, but it's not too much of a culture shock for me. I actually have a home here in Florida in Fort Myers. It's kind of my off-season base.
Okay.
We're renting a home here in Tampa, so pretty smooth from that end. The Raptors did a phenomenal job. They just opened a brand new JW Marriott downtown. We've kind of overtaken like one whole floor of the convention center space, and they built a practice facility, weight room, offices, locker rooms, everything here, and it's amazing. It blow you away if you walked in here. It really looks good. They've done a great job. So, but again, your question, they're not a lot similar.
You know,
Toronto's a really big city feel, cold weather. You know, lots of people from all over the world getting along, living together in a really cool, culturally diverse city. And down here, it's kind of spread out in shorts and t-shirts and flip flops. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Understood. I mean, I would just think. I think of Toronto being so culturally rich, and I don't. But I've never spent any time in Tampa. I've spent some time in Florida. I find that. I would imagine that there's a stark difference in those, but you're a seeker of cultural experiences. So I figured if there was anything in Tampa that appealed, you would have found it.
Not yet. Plus the protocol keep us from not.
Yeah, fair.
Keep us from not doing a whole lot either. So you're just kind of trying to stay safe and be able to continue doing your job and enjoying the sunshine. Though the people have been nice. It's been good. It's been good, Rick.
So you've won a lot of championships. For those who may not know, you won a lot of championships before you ever reached Toronto. High school as a player, overseas as a coach, what, 8-9 times, and then again in the D or G League. And I've always contended that understanding what it takes to win it all at any level, having accomplished that, having experienced it, is an invaluable asset or advantage in trying to win it again at any level. But I've always struggled to describe what that asset or advantage that you get from having done it. Can you pinpoint that thing that you, and I mean, I don't even know if you agree with that premise, but
no, I do.
What is it that you could take from your previous experiences that you look at and say, you know what, this was what allowed me to get the job done with the Raptors, especially, you know, coming in and doing it your first year?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ooh, really good question. Well, I think, as simple as this is going to sound, like even with the Raptors, like, once we kind of got going, I mean, I kind of believed we could do it, right? I kind of like, you know, right away into the season, I was like, man, we got a team that can contend for this thing. And then I think that you just never really waver from that. And that's a big part of it, you know? I think that, I go back to high school. I think we went into that season thinking we're going to win it.
Yeah.
We understand like there's really good teams and it's a long road and there's going to be some bumps but we've got enough, you know, whatever mental fortitude to do it. And I think that kind of just kind of keeps building up and it certainly was the case with Toronto. I think we started that thing with very high expectations. I don't think anybody was talking about us winning at all, but internally we were. And we just kept getting better and better as each series went on. And then the players just became super determined. And they just were going to win it. When we got to the finals, it was like, we're going to win this thing, you know.
Yeah.
And they really laid it on the line and played extremely hard and followed the game plan and were super, super smart, Rick. Man, we were changing things on the fly, up, you know, changing coverages and doubling from one way on one side of the floor and doubling from another on the other side. I mean, we were really doing some high level stuff in a pressure cooker, and that was just a credit to them and their experience, IQ, and toughness.
Does it matter to you at all that some people have discounted it because of the injuries that the Warriors suffered along the way? Like, how do you reconcile that with the achievement?
I don't really, doesn't really bother me at all. I think that, geez, we beat them 6 times that year in their own arena. I mean, we beat them twice. We beat them 5 times, I think, in their own arena, and 6 times we beat them at home.
Yeah.
Pretty handily. We beat them in Golden State pretty handily in the regular season. You know,
yeah.
We won 4 games on the road in the playoffs. So it doesn't bother me too much.
So you may not know this, but I actually had you guys going to the finals again last year without Kawhi, because one, I thought, as we, you know, discussed, like there was an intrinsic value in having accomplished it that you were going to have over just about everybody else in the league, especially with the Warriors clearly not being the same. Like, you had an advantage. You knew what it took to get there, and that you were going to have the motivation of your team – you know, all the guys other than Kawhi to say, hey, look, we weren't just a one-man band. We were good and we won for reasons beyond Kawhi, and that would be a really powerful motivator. And then I just, you know, you had young guys getting better. I thought the door was still open for you to get it done. Mm-hmm. But now you're in a position where it's a year later and a number of pieces have changed. Like, to me, this is might be one of the hardest challenges a coach can ever have, which is when you have a group that has, as you said, like, can play for a championship, knows it's capable of winning a championship, and now you're like, what do you gun for? What's the motivation now for this team? How do you get guys to make the sacrifices necessary to play at their peak if the reward isn't like the same carrot that you had been chasing the last couple years?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly different. I think, you know, you've already mentioned it. I think we're, you know, four probably of our top six off that championship team are no longer here. And Danny Green, Kawhi, Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, you know, all prominent players in the league.
Sure.
You know, very prominent players in one way or another, either as team players, defenders. You know, Kawhi does it all, obviously. It's been difficult. Obviously, our start was not good. I think, you know, the move and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm just approaching it like always, man. I'm just trying to get this team to max out, you know, and reach its potential, continue to develop some of these young guys. And again, we've played a heck of a lot better than probably our 7-11 record shows. You know, we've been very, you know, almost every game has been right there. We had maybe one or two sinkers, but out of 18 games, we've had 16 that have, you know, literally within the last 2 minutes have been going to go either way. So we just got to, again, extend our good minutes of play, figure out how to piece in some of these new guys, eliminate, you know, some of our poor plays, got to come up to average, you know, and extend those good minutes of play. And I think this team will continue to grow. We'll just see where it goes from there.
So one of the guys that I expected to grow is Pascal Siakam. And I was fascinated watching how you used him in the bubble and even now at the start of this season. And having read almost the entire book, Rapture, I felt like I discovered something in the book, because I had a question about, it felt to me as if you were thrusting him into that role, the Kawhi role, not completely, but giving him a lot of ability to create or to be that center point. And he's, I think it's fair to say he's at least struggled in that somewhat. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
But you kind of stuck with it, and you stuck with him in the bubble. And yeah, I'll be honest, like, I'm watching, I'm going, give him the ball at the top of the key. That I don't know that that's going to work. What inspired you, or what is your thinking process in going with that and sticking with it?
Well, we obviously came back into that year, you know, with Kawhi gone and you know, the opportunities for him to kind of move up another kind of level as mm-hmm. the go-to guy or the playmaker were there. And he was unbelievable, Rick. I mean, he was playing well. He made second team all NBA last year. I mean, he was doing it. Even we had a 5-game road trip, right before March 11th when the pandemic hit, and he just was slicing and dicing all the way in the fourth quarter of every one of those games. He's either scoring or finding it, you know, creating the shot for other guys. And we closed out all those games, you know, on the road at some tough places and big wins, and we were rolling and he was rolling at a super high level. And for whatever reason, I mean, he wasn't alone. There were certain guys that just didn't react very well to the all the time off. And he never really got his groove back. And I guess from my standpoint, I was hoping that that guy would play his way into who we had leading into the pandemic. You know, and that's, I guess that's it. He just didn't quite come out of it. Even Marc Gasol didn't come out of it playing the way he played, you know, and that saying all that, we come within a possession of getting past Boston. And if we would have, who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. No, I get it. And it's also a matter of like, what are your alternatives at that stage? Right. I mean, this is a guy who's made your team successful playing that way. I totally get that. I guess I expected coming back to this season, knowing Pascal a little bit, like he would have been super motivated and he would have turned it or found that groove, especially coming back in a regular season where, let's face it, you know, not everybody's dialed in right now, right? But I wonder if some of the personnel that you've lost has changed the spacing for him too and just made it a lot harder, that's a factor in his struggles in being able to get to where he wants to get to. And for me, it's just being able to handle the ball in tight space. It's looked like it's the biggest struggle for him, being able to get a shot.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I think the personnel changes certainly affect it. You know, just changes the rhythm, right, of what you're used to seeing.
Yeah.
And it's going to take him some time. He got off to a poor start. He had a good stretch of about four or five games, and then he's, you know, struggled a little bit, picked up a little bit of a leg injury. So it's a little bit of a working process to try to get him back to that guy, but he's shown a few flashes here this year, but we're just trying to get him to be that energetic on the floor, open floor, you know, play on the catch a little quicker guy that he had all the success with.
Yeah. So what is it that you think that this team is capable of? We talked about like setting that bar, or what's the goal? What is it that you think that you've sold this team on, or that you aspire to achieve with it?
Well, I think, again, Rick, first thing we got to do is get ourselves playing just a little bit better, right? I think, again, there's been a lot of good play. I just want to get in contention to get in the playoffs, right? I think you got to do that first, and we're going to have to continue to improve and build up, get some of these younger guys experiences, get the OG Ananobis of the world to move up a level, Norman Powell's, those guys are getting, you know, they've been with us a few years now, and they need to take over leadership type bigger roles. We've got to develop some type of big man rotation, you know, that can pick up the pieces that Mark and Serge left there. And that's it. I just think that you got to get in the playoffs, and then I take our chance. I think, again, on a nightly basis, that we come out and we give teams a lot of trouble. And if we could just play just a little bit longer stretches of better basketball, we can get on the right side of the win-loss column.
For some people who may not know, you've been a figure in the evolution of the way the NBA game is played in terms of being more of a drive and kick, the emphasis on three-pointers. If I'm not mistaken, I think you guys lead the league right now in three-point attempts. And you're known for your offensive creativity. I wonder, what's your feeling about the game today and the way it's being played, the state of the game?
Well, I mean, I think it's the game has evolved. As you know, I would say the first thing is, you know, take 6 years ago or something and fast forward to today, the amount of threes that people are shooting, it's just an astronomical difference.
Yeah.
Right. So offenses pretty much league wide have gone to a lot of spacing and a lot of five out, a lot of bigs that shoot, a lot of more pick and pop, those kind of things. I'm not sure the defensive side of it has adjusted as quickly, but I see that coming. People are changing the way they're guarding more. It's pretty, you know, it used to be a little standard. Everybody kind of had the same coverages night in and night out, right? And but I think that's changing. You're seeing a lot more zone. You're seeing a lot more, you know, just different man-to-man principles to cover the evolving offense. I mean, I think we're here, Rick. I obviously believe it's really hard to guard the ball, right? And there's a lot of people penetrating, and if you want to stop those guys at the rim, you got to send another body, and that means it's got to get kicked out. And that ends up in the results of a lot more threes going up. So I think that's the state. I think it's good. I think the league's as competitive as ever. You know, I think the games are great, and I like it. I'm happy with it.
Yeah, my lifelong goal is to never become a salty, cynical person or writer.
Get off your lawn.
Yeah. I aspire never to become that, right? And so there's a part of me that, like, I just wonder, you know, having covered this game and watched it and et cetera for years, I feel as if it's become homogenized a bit, in that everybody's the style has become kind of unified, and that the creativity is there is creativity. I think the athleticism has produced a creativity that, you know, across the board, we're seeing guys do things that we used to think were spectacular and now seem to be commonplace. But the intricacies of team play, to me seem to be dumbed down. And you, having been, you know, creative from the beginning, are you seeing the same thing, or am I missing something? Is there something that the guy on the porch is not, he needs to put his glasses on because he's not appreciating something?
No, I mean, I think you're kind of right. You know, you said that kind of a lot of teams are playing the same way, but yet there is still the, I don't know, some of the high volume leading scorers in the league have the ball every possession down the floor, right? And they're playing pick and roll and pretty much deciding what happens on every possession. Either they're shooting it or passing it to the guy who is shooting it, right?
Yep.
I don't necessarily love that. I love the space and the pass combinations and the back door and the hit the roller and the kick out. And I mean, I certainly love a much more almost international feel where the ball's popping around a little bit, but there's a lot of, like you said, you're seeing a little bit of everything. You're seeing a DHO on one side and a pin down screen on the other, and the guy comes back and now you're into another ball screen and it hits the roller and it gets kicked out to the corner, you know, where there's, everybody gets to play.
Yeah.
You know, everybody develops their skills that way. And to me, there's nothing better than watching a team that moves the ball.
Agreed.
You know, passes the ball, moves the ball. That's what I want to watch.
Who would you say, when you look around the league, you don't get the vote for the Toronto Raptors, who do you look at and say they still maintain or come closest to maintaining that equal opportunity offense?
Well, I mean, I still think San Antonio does as well as anybody. I really do. They play with pace. They cut hard. They get it from side to side. You know, I think they were one of the people in the forefront of that, man, when they had those great teams, man, were they fun to watch, right? And even, you know, I think Golden State, man, you know, obviously they had some of the greatest shooters ever known all on the same team, but they did. I just digress here a little bit. That was one of the things that playing against them that was, I couldn't believe how fast they ran. Like the entire game, how fast they were moving on offense. Like, I mean, talk about conditioning and talking about a mentality. I remember saying to my team several times in the series, I know they're running fast. And you run fast too. You run fast too and chase them. You know, I remember saying that over and over in the locker room.
I'm sure that went over big with Marc Gasol.
No, it just blew me away. It did. It just blows you away watching how fast, you know, Curry and Thompson and Draymond and those guys were just doing it. If the speed and still the rhythm to do it with timing and, you know what I mean? Just like one little mistake and bang, you paid for it either with a back cut or a three ball, you know, just at electrifying speed. It was really something to watch them play.
Well, to me, that's the thing, is it's not just the physical speed, because I think we have a lot of that in the game today, but it's their mental speed, their ability, you know, the instant that somebody's leaning the wrong way or the defense is a step slow, that not just one guy, not the guy with the ball, but there would be two, three guys who would recognize, oh, there's our opening, boom, they'd hit it. And to me, that's the beauty of the game, is that communication, that recognition, that collective recognition of something that happens, and you work together. And that's the part that I don't see enough of, you know. It's I mean, you've probably done it yourself, like the number of possessions that are one pass and a shot in today's game is extraordinary. And it feels a little tedious to me at times. I hate to say that about a game that I love and a league that I've loved covering, but I say it because I love, you know, it worries me a little bit.
No, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the open floor, I think the pace has picked up so much too, Rick. A lot of people really pushing the ball and running. It's hard, you know, it's hard again to guard the ball. You know, the hand checking's been taken out. You know, it's you know, you put your head down and head towards somebody, the guy pretty much has to get out of the way.
Yep.
You know? And you better have somebody else coming in behind them to fill in, or it's a layup, and usually that means it's kicked out. And like you said, there's that one pass, and the shot's up. So I think the pace, the open floor, hand checking, et cetera, have all kind of contributed to that. And I don't know, we've probably all contributed to a little bit.
Yeah. No, I get why it works. I mean, by the way the game's being officiated, it works. I wonder if there's something that needs to be done to change that. And, you know, my idea is, and this is going to be revolutionary, especially for someone like you, but I wonder if you got rid of the three-point line and maybe made the lane bigger, not just wider, but longer, would that achieve something? Would that make a difference, or is that too revolutionary? I even hate asking the question for someone who is a devotee of the three-point shot as much as you are to suggest that. But I'm just thinking of, you know, I'm thinking of ideas that some way to structure the game so that it forces more creativity and more team play.
Well, I think that would change the game. Right. I mean, part of the reason that the threes are going up is just simple math, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's simple math that you know, an 18 footer is worth two and a 22 footer is worth three, and you shoot them at about the same clip, except for you get 50% more points, you know? So it's just, that's part of it. So if you wipe that out, you know, I think you're probably seeing a lot, you know, a lot different shots taken for sure. Change the spacing a little bit for sure. I'm not so sure that the hand checking and things that seem to be in play for a long time in basketball aren't a bigger culprit.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. That if defense was allowed to play a little more physically, that it would force teams to play and move the ball and not get stuck, right?
Force more screening and passing.
Yeah.
Force more screening and passing away from the ball.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great point. I think that may be the simpler approach. I don't know if we'll ever get there, but I agree with you. By the way, speaking of threes, this is the great question. I thought I would have it answered in the book. And it's when it's rare when a player, and you didn't mention it. This is what strikes me. So It is rare when a player can shoot threes better than he can shoot free throws. And yet, that's exactly, you know where I'm going. That's exactly what you did your junior year at Northern Iowa. You led the Mid-Continent Conference in threes that year, but you might have been the only guy the opposing coach would say, hey, look, if he's shooting a three, foul him. Like, so you got to explain to me how an acolyte of shooting, which you are. I mean, the nurse's pill has a ball designed to teach proper shooting. Obviously could shoot it. Please help me understand how that might have
okay,
been.
Okay, well, I think if I can remember correctly, I shot about 49% from three that year.
Yep, and like 47% from the free
and
throw
I shot
line.
47% from the free throw line.
Yeah.
I don't know. I obviously was in a mental funk that year at the free throw line. I cannot explain it. It was I wasn't very good at layups either. I used to miss a lot of good hands. I'd get some steals. I'd be out there 1-on-1, and I'd blow a few of those too. So anyway, I don't know. Just a mental funk that year. The rest of the years, I shot the free throw pretty good. And then when I went and played in England, I shot over 90%. So I did get it figured out.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I couldn't dig up the what was it? It wasn't Brighton. It wasn't Birmingham. Where were you the first year there?
I played Derby.
Derby. That's right. Yep. Yeah. So you shot 90% there. Interesting. All right.
Yeah. That's not in the book either.
Those those stats in Derby are hard to come by, my friend. Basketball Reference has a lot, but they don't have those. To wrap it up, I'm just wondering, when you look at where guys are shooting from now, I mean, they make it look so easy, and there's so many guys who can do it that are shooting from 35, 40 feet. First of all, mm-hmm. what's as somebody who appreciates and is devoted to shooting form, what's it like for you to see that happen and evolve over the course of your coaching career?
Well, first of all, I think it's really interesting, right? I think, probably Steph Curry gets that started, right, mm-hmm. with some of the pull-ups and bombs that he starts shooting and kind of players see his lower release point, you know? It's
yep.
obviously more power.
Yep.
You know, if you and I were going to take a half-court shot, we'd bend down and shoot it from our waist to make it go.
Yep.
It required distance, right? And
yep.
and that's just kind of what he does. Shoots it lower, and he has more power to shoot that. And, you know, then you obviously see the rest of those guys saying, well, let me try some of that. Lillard talks about really having a strong core. He really works on his core, and he gets a lot of his power to shoot from his core, which is another interesting thing to talk about. But, again, it's just the search for more space. Rick, you know, always say offense is about creating space and defense is about taking that space away. And when defenses are pulling a second defender off to stop the ball handler, guys are just trying to stretch that out, you know, open up those driving lanes. And they figure they can shoot maybe 8 feet behind the line uncontested or shoot on the line with somebody flying at him and making it highly contested. So
yeah.
they back up. So there's a lot of stuff going into that, you know?
Yeah. So where does this, where do you see the game going with this? Are we, and I'm really curious in terms of like players and positioning and shooting, like what's the next iteration of how the game is going to be played?
I don't know. I do think that the distance will continue to increase. I think you'll see multiple players on teams being able to shoot a lot deeper. I think that almost everybody on the team is going to be a driver of the basketball. You know, I think everybody's mm-hmm. going to see lanes to drive in because of trying to take away three-point shooting. And And one through five, those guys are going to be trying to take their matchups and put it down, where I don't think that would have been the case at all, you know, 10, 15 years ago for sure. But yeah. I just think you'll probably see it continue to roll this way with players doing all skills, you know, handling, passing, shooting.
All right, so my last question, and by the way, how did I do? I wanted to get a healthy number of questions you'd never been asked before. I don't know what the scorecard reads, but...
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. You got some good stuff out of me.
Okay.
So I haven't thought about that 47% in a long, long time, for sure.
I waited till the end, but that was the one that I was hanging on to. But here's my last one that I'm hanging on to, I had in my back pocket. There is visual evidence that you wore a black tie with a black shirt and a black suit while coaching in England. Please explain yourself.
I don't know if there's any explanation for that, really, what? Other than that was probably the fashion of the day.
No, but, you know what?
I was just trying to fit in, man. Black was hot back then, and I just put it all on in one day. And I wasn't trying to be Johnny Cash or anything like that, even though I'm a big Johnny Cash fan. But I just was probably fashion of the day, man.
I was alive then, and I was trying to recall whoever. I mean, monochrome was a thing at one point, but whoo! I saw that and I said, "Okay, I got to ask about this. I don't know if there's a reason behind
it." You could ask me about a lot worse things than that dressing wise. I tell you that much. Well, thanks for letting me off the hook.
No, not a problem. I just wanted to touch the subject. I didn't want to dive full in. All right. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun for me. I don't know if it's been any fun for our listeners, but I wanted to make it interesting for us, and I achieved it with me at least. So, Coach, thank you very much for taking the time. It's always a pleasure. I wish you the best of luck and health going forward.
All right. Thanks. Good talking to you after all these years, man.
So that does it for this episode of Bucher and Friends with Toronto Raptors head coach Nick Nurse. Don't forget, please rate and review the show on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. It's a small kindness that you can do for the show. It does matter as far as our ratings and our sponsors. In the next podcast, if all goes right, we will be joined by Blazers swingman Rodney Hood. Sure to ask him about Charles Barkley putting $100,000 on the Blazers to win the championship. Also talk to him about why veterans like himself and Carmelo Anthony seem to find a groove playing in Portland. If you have any questions that you'd like to be asked of Rodney, send them to @BucherFriends on Twitter, and we will try to squeeze them in. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.